The Team Never Quit podcast is brought to you by...
The biggest honor of my military career was being called to be an instructor at our fighter weapons school, formerly now called the U.S. Air Force Weapons Instructor Course, but basically it's the Air Force Top Gun program.
Team Never Quit. Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Welcome back to another episode of Team Never Quit Podcast. Thank you all for listening, watching, viewing, and subscribing. If you want to stay up to date with what we've got going on, check out our social medias at @team_neverquit. All right, let's kick it off with our Patreon question of the day, which is, what holidays did your family really go all out for when you grew up? And do you still do it for the same holidays today?
Well, Hunter is our son, so he can answer that.
Well, I know 100% Thanksgiving is the craziest holiday for us.
Yeah.
Always been. We have a squad of friends, family, even people we don't even know coming out to our ranch. And
we do. We have, like, friends bring friends.
It becomes a whole mini city at our ranch.
Like, we have this kind of big open invite to our friends and family for Thanksgiving, and people will bring, like, their people. Like, oh, it's Thanksgiving. Let me bring my family, which is awesome. We love it. We love getting to meet everybody, and thankfully we have the room for it. So it's just, it's such an awesome dynamic. Marcus's favorite is Christmas by far. So we do, like, Griswold's family Christmas at the house, but it's really just us as, like, our immediate family. We don't do a big, like, huge family Christmas since we do the big, huge family Thanksgiving.
What do you got?
So from the Team Teschner standpoint, Christmas by far, bar none. Growing up, it meant coming back to St. Louis, which is the global headquarters for our family, if you will. And we'd come in from wherever Dad was stationed. We'd have the Christmas Eve with his side of the family, Christmas Day with my mom's side of the family. Those were the happiest of times because it was the one time that I got a chance to be with our family since we were always living someplace other than where all of my cousins were. So happiest of memories from back in the day.
Oh, that's fun.
What about you, John?
It's going to be Christmas as well. That's our big blowout. Thanksgiving is kind of the holiday where family members will trade off and go to the in-laws. And so not everyone will always be at every Thanksgiving, but Christmas, pretty much everybody's always there. We have a big, we get up in the morning, go to my parents' house. We kept that tradition alive. I take the kids over to my mom's and we open presents there. And then we'll open presents with my wife's mom. And then we'll go to the big Christmas thing with my mom's family and all that.
See, we don't like to leave at Christmas. We want to be in our house.
One of the holidays you have to be at the house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't want to go anywhere, and we get invited and thank you for the invites, but we just like to, Christmas is our time to just really soak it up.
Everybody
in our
has
house.
To be in their onesie. You don't clean up the wrapping paper.
Yeah.
All day.
From
all
October day. 31st, excuse me, October 1st through Halloween. That's Halloween month. You're supposed to watch a scary movie on the TV, a different one every day. You know, you get your costume all planned out, you decorate, and then you have Thanksgiving.
All month of Thanksgiving.
And all month of Thanksgiving movies and getting prepped for that. And it's this whole build up. And then December, you have Christmas. January is that kind of down. And then February, I think each month is designed for something. Like, we have basketball and sports throughout the summer. Football comes online just about the time guys are going crazy through all that. You know what I mean? And I added as many traditions as I possibly could to the family, hoping some of them stick.
Yeah, he has a traditions book.
I mean, I wrap outside of the kids' bedrooms and wrapping paper. So the first present I get is them, right? They come running out of there. That's the best. And then I do that So many of those freaking...
Y'all jump in the pond on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, a tradition. We've done that since I was a boy. Every Christmas Eve, we go jump in the water as a ritual cleanse, right? And then there's a bunch of stuff.
Now, I have to say about Thanksgiving for us, we actually do a 10-day Thanksgiving. It's the Friday before, and then the whole week, and we don't go back until badass. Sunday.
Every day's an awesome meal.
And we have, all of these meals planned out, and we do a turkey trot. So all of those haters on Thanksgiving turkey trots, it's year. So much fun.
I can promise you I don't think the same thing.
Hey, I will throw one additional point in now that you mentioned all these, even turkey trots. I've tried to impose the Teshner Christmas on my own nuclear family right now. We were leaving New Mexico one year to go back to St. Louis because that's what I know as being the best Christmas ever. And our oldest son, Michael's in tears. He's aww. Like, Dad, how can you do this? How is Santa Claus going to find us? And it was at that point when I realized that maybe my version of Christmas was a little bit different from what it was that they wanted from us. And so we stopped traveling on Christmas specifically for the kids. And now it's become, although it's a little bit easier now that we're in St. Louis, but prior to that, it became exactly what it is that you're describing. Yeah. Something that was local to us, we ended up doing. Because different experience, different time frame. And so be it.
Oh, I love it. That was
awesome. All right, so we've got a really great guest for you guys today. Robert Cujo Teshner is an award-winning fighter pilot. He's an award-winning writer with 2 number one best-selling books. He holds advanced degrees in operational art and science and national security strategy and extensive experience in tactical planning and execution organizational leadership. He's also served as a U.S. Air Force's expert in post-mission debriefing. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for having me on. Can I tell you what a joy it is to be here with you today?
We're excited.
I appreciate that, man. That's going to be fun. It's going to be fun, man. I was going through your file. Obviously, it's extensive. If there's more than one page in here, that's when I know I'm dealing with something that's really got some legs on it and do some work. So, but the way we like to do it is just introducing everybody to you. Like I said, we're about to introduce you to our team and make you famous.
Awesome.
And where do you come from?
Yeah, so I've always claimed St. Louis is home, but St. Louis doesn't really accept me. I wasn't born here. Dad was in the Air Force. Dad served as an intelligence officer in Vietnam and then became a Jajavika general and took us around the world as part of his career, which I loved. I loved being part of the Air Force family. So we've lived all over the place. I'll always gravitate to St. Louis because this is where Dad was born and raised. And I'll talk about my mother separately.
So, I mean, was grandfather in the military? How far back do y'all go?
So grandfather was in the military. He was able to be a fighter pilot right at the end of World War II. So he finished training, war ended, didn't get a chance to participate. But my grandfather on my mother's side was in World War II as a member of the Croatian resistance. So mom was born in Zagreb, Croatia, and she was a war refugee. And her story of how it is that she comes to the United States ought to be turned into a movie. It's a very, very inspirational story. It's a story of maintaining hope when there was none and continuing to fight to get to where it is that you need to be. So that's something I'd be happy to share with you. But ultimately, there's different ways of serving in the Teshner household. And then our generation, my brothers and I, we all joined the military as well.
How many siblings do you have?
2. Anthony is my middle brother. John's my youngest brother. Anthony was Navy. John was Army.
Nice
work.
Yeah.
So we have across the board in my family, too. I got a cousin who lives across the street. She was an Apache pilot. And then, I mean, just it makes for interesting family reunions if you have
it
those.
It does.
It does, right?
It does.
All the time interesting. Because there's always something going on with the military, whether it's sports or whether we're fighting or whether just there's anything in between. That's cool.
Exactly.
We all have that, man.
Yeah, and we pick on each other constantly, which I absolutely love.
Military
makes
you good at that.
It does. It hones those skills very accurately.
Bro. Man, I'm so you get me fired up. I'm not even on point, man. Yeah, it does that for sure.
So when did you decide you were going to serve?
As soon as Dad decided, actually, I'll take it back.
Okay.
Star Wars, 1977. When Luke Skywalker wants to go join some academy and then go join the rebellion, that resonated with me for whatever reason.
I heard that.
Yeah, that was a big deal. And then fast forward 1986, Top Gun comes out, and I saw it twice. First time was in a German movie theater, which was all dubbed in German, which was weird. And then the second time was at Spangdahlem Air Base with a bunch of Air Force fighter pilots, which didn't matter. At the end of that movie, at the base theater, everybody stood up afterwards and just started screaming, like hooting and hollering, just fired up.
Yeah.
And that's where I knew as a young kid, I had to go do this.
Yeah,
thing.
Thank so you, Tom Cruise, for saving America.
That's right. That's exactly right. And when
I don't
Dad
know if you'll
retired,
ever hear this,
I remember
man,
being.
But Cujo and I are saying, thanks for saving America, Tom.
Yeah.
And when Dad retired, I was so disappointed because I really felt like the military was my family. I grew up, you know, around it.
Talk about that. Yeah. I've never heard anybody say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a kid, I felt like the military was my family. It's what I knew. I knew that I identified with the other kids that were being uprooted in three-year increments. And so when we'd show up at a new place, I knew that those people were going through the same thing that I was. I also knew that it was a bit of an adventure. You know, some people were upset about the moves. I thought it was an adventure. I loved going someplace new. Some of them were harder than others, but all of the time it was an adventure. And then I felt like you knew that your family was going to take care of you when you arrived at the next place. And so it struck me that no matter where we were on the planet, somehow we were always welcome. It was a special experience. And that kind of stuck with me. When Dad announced that he was retiring, I was a little bit depressed. I was like, no, you can't do this. This is our family. And so I announced the day that he retired, I announced that I'm getting in. That's how it went.
Matt, how old were you?
Oh, gosh. I was a sophomore in high school. Yeah, sophomore in high school.
So nobody ever talks about them.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never seen a movie or read a book about them or anything but the brats. Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of the guys will get in. Some of the brats will go in afterwards, but then a lot of them don't.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of hang out and go their own ways. You'll catch it in conversation. They normally don't bring it up, but they're their own little fraternity.
That's right.
The brats, man.
It's so interesting. And that's such a good outlook that you have, like that it was an adventure. Is that something that your parents kind of whispered in your ear at a young age? Like this is going to be fun. And as a way of like encouragement, getting over the fear, or you just naturally had that?
I think I naturally had it. You know, and I had a globe-trotting family to begin with. Again, mom was a war refugee, lived in Germany as the GIs were taking care of the war refugees, handing out chocolate, handing out little trinkets, trying to help these kids who were displaced, had no, you know, clear future ahead of them. Everything was kind of downtrodden. You know, she grew up in that, ended up in Brazil, learned, you know, multiple different languages along the way trying to get over here. So it wasn't... It didn't feel like it was anything that unnatural, but the part that was most interesting to me was that I thought it was always cool to hop on an airplane, to go someplace new, to be in a different situation, to meet new people along the way, especially internationally. And I got so much from it, and it became so ingrained in who I was that I couldn't really see not happen. And in fact, I felt bad for those who didn't get that experience.
Mm.
You know, I even felt a little bit bad. I mean, I have plenty of cousins who have grown up in St. Louis, have never really left St. Louis, traveled around a little bit, but haven't experienced anything other than that. I've always felt like they're missing a little bit. You know, there's something about learning international culture and understanding how we all interrelate as human beings that I think is really important.
Yeah, that's so neat.
Oh, it's a great skill set to have. Like those people who want to grow up and have that Jason Bourne kind of James Bond life mentality, that's how you have to get that.
That's right.
The people teach you that. And if you can survive, and you hear about the young ones, they'll throw a backpack on, go across and do the walks and the hostels and stuff like that. That takes some stones.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It does.
That builds personality. That there's something to that.
Amen. And what I found is that with our family, though, you know, the oldest said, hey, don't uproot me for Christmas, Dad, because Santa Claus is not going to find me. He was probably four when he had that realization. I just had a conversation with Michael yesterday. So we've got five children. He's the oldest. He's 17. And he said, Dad, you know, this is the longest we've ever lived anywhere. And if you decided that we needed to move someplace else, I'm all in, because it's part of who I am, he says to me. So even this generation of Teschners has gotten that ingrained, which I think is pretty neat. You know, we lived as a family in Greece. We lived as a family in Germany. We've got friends in multiple different countries. We've experienced places that you don't typically... You know, in a course of a lifetime experience, and what a rich, what a wonderful background that is for the children.
Oh, They don't even know what they don't know they don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
The best way I could say that, because actually get your butt out there, and to me, as soon as we step off the plane, I can smell it. The air smells different to me. I know immediately when I'm outside the country.
That's right.
And then when those realities, you can actually go back in time. I mean, that was a beautiful thing about it, what I saw. And that's why it feels differently when you travel around and the time change, because you can travel back to a village that was stuck back in the 1900s. It's still there. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely still there. And you can talk to the people and you can understand kind of how, if you, not at a young age, you can't appreciate that. I think it takes some reflecting time to put all that together as well. Life does that to you, but man, what a blessing it is to travel.
Mm-hmm. It is. Totally. And I'm very, very grateful that my family just was into that. I was fortunate to have that piece of the branch of the family be the one that I grew up in. And it affected my brothers and I tremendously in a good way, all positive.
College, then talk about that.
Yeah. So, again, going back to Luke Skywalker, he wanted to go to some mysterious academy that he never had a chance to go to. And for whatever reason, that stuck with me. And then when we, again, stationed at Spangdahlem Air Base in Germany, I remember one day being someplace on base and Dad saying, hey, look over there. Those two gentlemen, they're at the Air Force Academy. They're cadets. And so that kind of reinforced the Luke Skywalker thing. And then just practically speaking, when I'm coming into, hey, it's time to join the service time frame, we're shifting strategy. Like, we're about to have a totally different dynamic. The Soviet Union's crumbling. The military's downsizing. We don't need as many people in the service any longer, or so say. The leaders, and so the Air Force is kind of not really that keen on building new pilots. And so I figured, if you want to be a fighter pilot, the best place to go would be the Air Force Academy. And so I made that my all-in push, because I knew that was the thing that I wanted to do. I wanted to fly fighter aircraft. Dad was in the Air Force. It just made sense. And so I applied for the Air Force Academy and was promptly rejected. So
that's how you know you're supposed to be there.
yeah, that was a bit of a bummer.
If most people knew where the Air Force Academy was, everyone would try to get in there. That place is so cool. Oh man,
it's a beautiful piece of real estate. It's not the funnest of places to go to school, but it's a fantastic piece of real estate. Yeah. Yeah, what? I got denied.
I don't want to hear anything out of you, Air Force, when it comes to badass schools, right? It's not any fun. Are you kidding me right now? I mean, I was in the Navy.
Marcus point. Always
probably
talks.
No one's audience, Cujo.
Right. Know your audience, bro. I got a bunch of wings in the background.
Marcus always tells like young men and women that want to join the service, they always, I want to be a Navy SEAL, I want to be an Army Ranger or whatever. And he's like, you need to go in the Air Force.
Join the frickin'
They have Air Force, the best bases. Yeah. They have the bet. They take care of their people.
I didn't know anything about y'all, just that y'all were had the wings. I get that. And went to outer space. That's all I thought, man. I thought y'all had the coolest rides and that was the best job. It was way outside of my pay grade. Kind of deal in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, well, it was almost out of my pay grade too, because my letter, the one that says, "Hey, thanks for applying," never said try again. It didn't even give me the option to potentially.
That was written in the bottom, dude. We wrote it on paper, like, bro. Don't ever.
You're not getting in. So did you just go straight into the Air Force then?
No, I'm the tail end Charlie for my class. Like, I got a call from the senator's office a couple of weeks prior to basic training saying, hey, congrats. And what that basically means is a bunch of other people had to turn down their appointments. So I am the last person, I think.
Or, bro, they could have traded places to you and had a bet. Like, there's no way this dude's going to make it.
Yeah, maybe.
Turns out to be the best guy we got going through.
Yeah. So it all works out in the end. And actually, it was a good strategic play, because halfway through freshman year, the chief of staff of the Air Force came there and said, I know I told you, or we told you, that if you were pilot qualified on graduation, you were going to fly airplanes, but that's no longer the case. So they significantly reduced the number of pilot slots, which fortunately, for me, I still had 3 years to get my act together to try to compete for one of those things. The seniors, the juniors, many of them were out of luck, which was very unfortunate.
Wow. What year was that?
Graduated in 95. So this was 91 in 1995 that I was in beautiful Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Nice.
An outstanding location for a service academy.
It was the 90s. How great were they? It's the times they shift, man. They shift up and down when it's like, hey, we don't have enough. We got too many kind of deal. Ebbs and flows.
That's right.
It's weird. So that's why they say you can never chase it. It's kind of lands on you.
That's right. Timing's everything.
So what's next after the Air Force Academy?
Yeah. So I got one of the pilot slots. I got my dream. I got to go to pilot training, went to Texas. So I was just up the road in Wichita Falls, Shepherd Air Force Base, learned how to fly airplanes, realized that I was built for this, even though I think most people, when looking at me, would have said, there's no way that you can make this. I was 145 pounds, sopping wet when I graduated the academy. I was a stick figure, I was not an athlete. I was none of the things that you'd expect for somebody that was doing that. And yet I knew in my heart of hearts that this is what I was made to do. And so the more people told me that it wasn't going to happen, the more committed I was to proving them wrong. And then went to pilot training, everything clicked. It was one of the best years of my life. Like when you think, you know, if you could go back in time and relive something, you know, what would that be? I would 100% relive pilot training. I loved it. Loved it. Loved it. Went to an international pilot training school. We had German students in the class, Italian students. We had some Turkish students early on, Portuguese, whatever, from the NATO alliance that, you know, at the time they were all going through school there. And it was such a wonderful experience. Loved it. Loved every minute of it. Miss it. Would love to go back and do it.
That's awesome.
So I've run across a couple of people that I think that's unique. Like the people say, hey, man, whatever it is you're wrapped in, if you don't look the part. But then there's inside, like, hey, I don't know why I know this, but I know my ass has to go do that.
Yeah.
I just know that. Like, everything in my life directs me into this path. Not only that, if I hear somebody tell me that I'm probably not the right person for the job, if I get in there and screw up, that's different. But, like, if you just showed up and someone tells you that, then that's how you know you're in the right spot kind of deal. I firmly believe that. So it's funny how that works out. And when you say it clicks, it does. People ask and say, hey, man, you got a friend. I'm like, some of that stuff just clicks.
Yep.
It's like, I don't know what that is. It's almost like the program's already in there. You just have to flip the breakers, right? You got to get in there and work it a little bit, and then it'll open up for you. It's part of it. It's like that feeling when people work out all the time. It's like, how do you get to that? It's like, well, there's something that comes with that. I mean, at a certain point, there's a feeling that locks in. You know as well, you don't talk about, bro, them guys, there's a feeling that comes with that.
And you 100%.
100%. You kind of want to stay in that.
Yes.
And I think that's the way it is with most things we do down here. If you put a little bit of effort into it, man, it'll give you that. It feeds you something.
To the point where, you know, these days, and I think we're very privileged, our generation is, that so many folks said, thank you for your service. Thank you for what you've done. I have a hard time accepting that on a number of levels. One of the levels is I got a chance to do what I knew was inside of me.
Yeah.
So like that.
That's a good point. Like, great point. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yep. Makes you feel weird, right?
It's very weird.
Doing and be like, well, this is actually what I do.
It's like, yes.
Yeah, it's what I wanted. That's
right.
To
do. Right. They don't ever see us. I get that. Yeah. I get that part. It's weird. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is either. But.
Mm-hmm.
What did you start off flying?
So. At the Air Force Academy, the first thing that I flew was a sailplane between freshman and sophomore year. So it's a glider. You're going out there trying to figure out how to not.
Mm-hmm.
That was fascinating.
What's it like getting launched? Yeah, I want to hear about that.
I had never flown an airplane before I went to the Air Force Academy, and now I'm behind. I got this little stick trying to fly an airplane with no motor, and you're trying to figure out how to get this thing from wherever the tow plane drops you off to the piece of landing strip over here off to your right.
Does it have wheels on it? Or is it just a flat?
It does. It's got one wheel on the front, maybe some like glider things. And then on the wings, they've got some stuff. Cause at some point the airplane tips over and, you know, in order to not destroy the wings, they've got something on the edges there, but that's it. It's a very, very basic thing. And it's stunning how quiet it is when there's no motor. It's also stunning how peaceful it is when there's no motor. And it's amazing to me how quickly you can become accustomed to not having a motor, figuring out how to land this thing effectively. And, you know, it wasn't but a few rides in that you solo, you're a 17, 18 year old kid and you're flying this thing solo. And it's so empowering. It's just an awesome experience. There's something spiritual about it. And it really resonated with me. Like that was the, yep, I'm in the right place. Everything here is worth it.
So how, if it's doesn't have a motor, how's it? I'm sorry, I'm very naive to this.
The wings are real long and it's light. It's really light. Yeah, so they tow it
very light. It's got the wings generate a lot of lift. The reason why Charles Lindbergh picked the Colorado Springs location for the Academy is it's great flying weather, and you've got a lot of funky things coming off the Rocky Mountains over there, which help you to be able. I mean, people who know how to soar, how to fly these sailplanes, they can stay airborne for hours, just riding the different currents of air and figuring out, you know, how to optimize things. So you have a tow aircraft that pulls you up. At some point, you release the rope that's been pulling you, and then boom, you're on your own. And it's a very unique experience. Something that I it further incentivized me, like, stay with this, you know, you're onto something here. This is cool. Don't get to do this in most walks of life. Harness this. And so we went from that. The next airplane was a single engine Cessna, you know, propeller driven airplane.
Hold on, let's back up a second. What do people, cause I mean, there's some people that freak out. You know, as well as I do, you pop that cord off. There's no putting that sucker back. I guess that's what eliminates that. Like, hey, right, man, you only got one option once you pull that cord.
You've only got one option. I mean, if you can figure out how to ride the waves and stay airborne forever, I suppose. But at some point, you do have to come back down.
Right.
And so, you know, the first couple of flights, you've got somebody in the back, you know, an instructor. It's a fellow student, by the way. It's another cadet. And that person is there to make sure that you do things the right way. But whenever he or she says, you're clear to solo, it's go time. And there you are. So it works. The program works. They've been doing it for decades, and it works brilliantly. And then when you get into pilot training, now you're flying jets. So everything's happening a lot faster.
So it's basically like flying a paper airplane. I
mean, first one is like sitting in a paper airplane with the ability to control the paper airplane.
That's what you're dealing with. So if you like doing the paper airplane thing, you would love.
That's nuts. Yeah.
You should try it at scale.
It is kind of nuts. It is kind of nuts. But I mean, most of the things that we do are kind of nuts, right? I mean, this military service thing involves doing a lot of things that are kind of nuts.
At the age we're at. And you can't appreciate that till we get older. It's like, man, the guys driving the aircraft carrier is 17, 18-year-old kid.
Uh-huh. Right.
The men in charge are in their 30s.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then the bosses, they're the highest. That's a 40 thing. Everyone thinks that you're ancient and dead. I was like, I really started living when I got in my 40s.
Exactly. Isn't that stunning how fast we accelerate leadership? How fast we accelerate somebody to realize their potential?
How about that? I guess because you got somebody coming up behind them, kicking them in the ass, and then you know, you're always trying to do better or just do your job because somebody else is coming. It's a brilliant way to live life.
It is.
If you could smash that military concept without telling everybody they're in the military into life, because everyone's trying to help, you get into medical and dental. Not only do you have to go, and they take care of your ass and get you back on. It's the best. You get fed. I mean, Americans wouldn't adopt that whole concept. We like having it around, but I don't know how you could. It was fun. I mean, I had a blast. I never thought I was in the military. I got lucky like that. I enjoyed all of it.
You know, I have to say that I enjoyed it the most when I was younger and when I was actually doing the missions. When I was at the tip of the spear, that's the part that was fun.
Well, you know, it was knowing fun that for you us. Were, look what we had to do. I mean, we had badass, man.
That's right.
You came in right at the freaking, and you had rank on you,
But see, rank wasn't a privilege when it came to executing the mission. The further up you got in the chain, the further away you were from actually tactically executing the mission. And I think that as I reflect back on my time, if there's a time period that I could freeze, it would be first lieutenant through captain, because that's when I was out there doing the mission. And the nice thing about the fighter world was that we were the ones that were out there doing the mission. So that to me, that was the purest time in my professional career. And that's the time that I gravitate back to. Those are the happiest memories that I have, for sure, bar none. And that was where it was just pure.
That's the best, right? We have that too. It's almost because you know what your job is and everyone else knows what your routine is. Like, you get to work out, sleep, eat, and feed and fight.
And you're being paid to be ready to fight. And that was the part that was inspiring to me.
That's the best. Because when you have downtime, your ass better be doing your downtime. You didn't go find anything else to do. You knew what was what. That's the same way it was for us in the mafia. At E5, guys, like, hey, you know your jobs. If it's time to watch TV, that's what you do. You sleep and then... But the fight was always different. That was what kept it real.
Mm-hmm.
You're right.
That's right.
So speaking of, you're in pre-9/11. So let's talk about once 9/11 hits and you realize you're actually going to war.
Yeah. So the interesting thing for my side of this, and I gave a presentation once to a group, and they had a Vietnam veteran as their sort of principal. And this Vietnam veteran had flown almost 200 missions in Vietnam. Okay, so when I finished speaking, the crowd, they gave me a standing ovation. And I said, I cannot accept your standing ovation. Like, I'm not worthy of your standing ovation, because the guy that brought me in here, he's an actual legitimate hero. Like, he's done the job. My generation did not have that same kind of fight, not in the fighter forces. He came back and he said, hey, Cujo, appreciate where you're coming from, but actually you can't pick your war. You did what you were called to do in your time frame. I did what I was called to do in my time frame, and you would have done the same thing that I did had you been born in my time frame. And I came back and I said, I appreciate what you're saying here, but what you're saying is an assumption or a supposition. What you did was a fact. I'd like to believe that I would have been you, but we'll never know, because I was never called to do that. We all know, though, that you are who you are, and you deserve all the accolades. My generation and my, you know, in the world that I come from, F-15, F-22, we were doing no-fly zone enforcement missions over southern and northern Iraq. And it was a totally different experience. Now, where was I on September 11th of 2001? I was in Saudi Arabia. I was an F-15 pilot. I was actually the mission commander for all U.S. forces flying over southern Iraq the next day. So I was in charge of Navy coming out of the Gulf, Army on call in Kuwait, U.S. Air Forces coming out of Saudi Arabia. But we were doing no-fly zone enforcement, so a totally different kind of mission. And it was just a different experience. I mean, my experience was, you know, making sure.
What was that like coming out of that, man? Did they pull the reins off y'all and let you just arm that sucker up?
No, because ultimately we were already armed to enforce the no-fly zone, right? So that was a daily mission, but the mission didn't change. We were just a status quo. We were a status quo element, and we continued to do that mission as things start to kick off in other places.
Yeah.
So it was a different experience. It was a completely different, you know, flying in hostile territory experience.
Yeah.
And I mean, our biggest issue was making sure that we didn't make the commander in chief's job any more difficult than it already was. Like, let's maintain the status quo, right, essentially was our approach, because he's got enough on his plate right now.
Oh, and you don't think about it. That's good. I've never thought about it like that. But when we get in and something like that happens, like a fight, then all the guys want to do is go and whip somebody's ass. Mm-hmm. And then you got the boss trying to figure out what's going on, how everything, and is it getting barked at from both sides. So if you got a good commander in chief, man, he'll sit down, look, listen, feel, examine before he goes in and does all that. Yeah.
So what does an F-15 do?
Yeah, so there's two different versions of F-15s. There's the air-to-air primary, like almost exclusive version, and then there's the one that does both, air-to-air and air-to-ground. So I flew the air-to-air version. So our job was to maintain air superiority, make sure that no enemy aircraft affects any of us.
Okay.
And air superiority has been very effective in the United States. We've maintained it consistently since 1953, so since the end of the Korean War, essentially. But that also means that if there is no enemy air force, or if there's no threat to us, then, you know, you may not have very much going on. And it's our ambition always to be part of things, but again, if there's no enemy aircraft to have to defend against or to attack, then there may not be very much for us to do.
Right. Not a lot of action, but you're making sure there's not a lot of action.
That's right. I mean, it would deterrent force for sure. Right. But I mean, we train to do the action. I mean, in our training missions, we're going out there, you know, treating each other like the threat, pulling nine times the force of gravity, ready to do all of the things we're supposed to do, just waiting for the call.
That's awesome.
And there's a lot of waiting for the call, in my experience.
Hurry up and wait.
Yeah.
That's right. Always.
You always hear that. You never know what it means till you get in, and there's situations that present itself, and then those squared away chiefs will always throw that line out. Thanks. Hurry up.
That's right.
And it's funny how our society rolls. Sometimes the violence of action will come in, and then they'll want to see it to reaffirm them that they have it. And then they'll say, well, hey, yeah, lock it down. We don't want to see any of that. So
yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? It's like, oh, are we too
that's
strong,
right,
or are we too lax? Yeah. Which one? Because there's going to be something that happens on both sides of that. And that's life, man.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I reflect back, you know, when I was at the academy, one of the things, and I'm a big fan, my dad introduced me to a book called Once an Eagle a long time ago, written by Anton Meyer. It traces two people as they're coming up through the ranks. One is a true warrior. One is a sort of politician warrior. So like not warrior, like total politician. And they're making their way through World War I, World War II, and then Vietnam. And it's interesting, in times of peace, it strikes me, and it always has, that folks will, you know,
how do y'all play treat the game. When y'all get, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I mean, when y'all get those guys in there, y'all have them too, right?
Oh, yeah. That's the
we got
them.
I've seen a couple of them.
And they rise when there's not much going on. What you need is you need to have the folks who are the warriors coming up through the ranks ready
like
to
that.
Go out there.
Mm-hmm. It's like crossing the streams, man. Them dudes don't like, and the gals, they don't like doing that.
And it's a weird dynamic. Yeah, it's an unfortunate dynamic, actually.
It's weird.
But what we need is a constant stream of warriors who are ready to go forth and do. And that's one of the things that there's a lull. You kind of tend to maybe lose a little bit of that, like the kind of fades away just a little bit. I mean, they're there, but the benefit of having something, a mission constantly, is that you keep the warfighters at the forefront. And that's what we as a nation need in order to be able to remain safe.
Sure. That's where those crusty ass Master Chiefs and Sergeant Majors.
That's right.
Man, them dudes. They don't like anybody. They're always grumpy, yes. And their job is at a younger age, you send it to them because nothing's ever right.
Right.
And it just keeps you in that stuck in this level to when you do get to see the reality of what it is, there is a calmness in it. But at a certain age, you're not supposed to see it. It keeps you sharp. I mean, if you don't stay, I agree with that. That's a one valuable lesson. People always ask me, like, hey, what'd you learn in the military? What valuable lessons, man? Most of them, the good ones, I don't ever talk about. That's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, bingo. Certain guys for certain positions because certain people at certain times. You talked about that, man. It was like, hey, you had to have those guys.
That's right.
So we see in your file from 2004 to 2006, you served doing post-mission briefing. Did you actually get to, in wartime in Afghanistan and Iraq, is that what you were briefing on, or what was that about?
No, so probably the biggest honor of my military career was being called to be an instructor at our fighter weapons school, formerly mm-hmm. now called the U.S. Air Force Weapons Instructor Course, but basically it's the Air Force Top Gun program. And when I showed up as a young
captain,
y'all
argue about that? Y'all do, don't you?
I mean,
because those,
of course we are. Of course we argue about that.
I mean, I just wanted to bring that to light. If y'all were wondering, hell yeah, they do, man. These guys can argue about some crap. You got, it's hilarious.
Oh, yeah. There is
so
no
why
doubt.
Why did they stop calling it the Top Gun?
That's Navy.
Oh.
But here's the thing. I mean, ultimate respect in both directions as
sure,
well.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So, of course, we're going to give each other grief, but ultimate respect. And so when I came back as an instructor, which for me, apex of the career, like that's where you go to really, really become well-versed in teaching. I got there at a time when we needed somebody to teach the post-mission debrief course, the way that we practice accountability for our missions. And of all the sexy topics that you could teach at a weapons school kind of a program, that was the least sexy. So I was not excited about it at all. But I was also smart enough to salute smartly and do as I was told. And that ends up being one of the best things that happens to me. Because since I was responsible for building how it is that we teach doing this, then I had an impact across the force, and it also shaped what it would be that I would eventually do later on in my life. I didn't know it at the time, but it was a tremendous blessing for me. It taught me a skill set that we do not practice very well across the globe. How do we practice accountability in a way that helps us to do better on the next mission and inspire our teammates to want to try again? That's something that is a... You have to talk secret sauce. Like that is a key enabler to our success on the battlefield.
I tell you what, when I go talk to the corporations like you're going to, that's the one thing they asked me about. And it was I didn't get this when I was young. My chief always kind of hammered this. He's like, the most important thing we do is that after action debrief. It was the most fun we had because you're all the guys are in it. Of course, we do it a little differently than the civilians might. But we have a little bit more fun with it. But that's when you come at each other. That's when you're like, hey, this is what happened. He's like, what were you thinking when you did this? And I mean, it really, what it really does is opens up conversation. Because that you find your gaps and then people have answers for it. And that's all that is. There should be nothing personal in the after action because that's what it was for.
That's right.
That's what you found out what it was all about is in there.
That's exactly right. And the thing that differentiates the high-performance team world that you and I come from is you have, if this after-action debrief thing is done correctly, a bunch of people that are arguing over who's more at fault if things didn't go well. And you contrast that with our society today and, this notion that I'm always going to point the finger someplace else. You know, I can excuse or justify my performance, behavior, whatever else. It's not my fault. It's 180 out from the way that your teams used to take a look at post-mission, what it was that was happening. And what I thought was most amazing about being in a fighter squadron was that in our debriefs, we'd have people that were arguing with each other over who was more to blame when things didn't go well. Yeah. Not trying to, you know, say, hey, I'll take all the credit over here when things went well. Like, that was a separate conversation and it also went differently. But when things didn't go well, you got a bunch of people saying, this is my fault, this is my fault, this is my fault, this is my fault. And the leader's stepping up and saying, no, actually, I own it. I'm the leader. I ultimately own this. And that is so special.
Yeah.
Right?
It's the best stories, too, because guys will come out the way they say it, like, you know, I was right here. And they're like, what happened? Like, oh, I ran out of talent. Right? They'll say something, anything to throw off the dynamic. And you're kind of like, well, that's brilliant. I didn't. You can't fault them for it. I mean, if they just care about, like, hey, look, man, I just ran out of damn talent right there in the door. And isn't that what you're for? That kind of thing. And guys just, you're not making fun. You just learn. I don't know what that is, how that happens, man, but we do it. And guys do it great. And I miss that so much. That's the one thing I miss, a freaking after action debrief.
So is that, I mean, I'm completely, a little background on me, Robert. I have no military background at all. And I learn something new every time I sit and listen to y'all speak. Do you do it like a post-mission?
Oh,
every time?
Every time. Every single time.
Is that like a week after or right after? Okay.
You can drop your kid off. You can drop your kid off, hit the head, and then you're in there. So everything's fresh. I mean, we're in there. We talk a little bit with each other. We joke around a little bit, but then the boss comes in and kind of everyone squares it away. And then he immediately, you know, you have what the job was, what you're supposed to do, what happened. And then we kind of throw those together, man.
It has to be. If it doesn't happen immediately after, we're going to forget things or misremember stuff. Yeah, we cannot afford to do that, right? Especially when you think about how emotionally charged some of these things are. Imagine losing somebody on a mission.
Yeah.
If you don't immediately debrief it, which I think is counter to what most people in a typical business setting would think, like, hey, we need to give ourselves some time to, like, you know, throttle back and emotionally come to grips with whatnot. No. If you do that, you're going to forget and you're going to misremember. And if you forget or misremember, then you're not going to draw the right conclusions. And that means that you're potentially carrying risk forward into the next mission, which for us is unacceptable. So it happens immediately. And at the weapons school where I was teaching this, we would have 20, 21, 22 hour debriefs, depending on the phase of instruction we were in. And those were painful because whoever's leading it standing the entire time. And yet, because of how much value you're trying to extract out of every mission. And a weapons school mission may last an hour, of which 35 minutes was tactical execution. We'll debrief that for almost a day.
So what's some of the best life lessons that you can take out of your post-mission briefs, debriefs, whatever, that you've implemented into daily life or into your book or your speeches or whatever you're doing now?
Yeah, here's the first one. Don't ever do a 24-hour debrief. Like, that's stupid. Like, only do that at the weapons school.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Hey, here's another one. I flew a training mission a million years ago with an instructor who was brilliant, just an absolutely brilliant fighter pilot, one of the best fighter pilots I've ever learned from. And so the way that it works when you're coming up through the ranks, kind of learning how to do this stuff, you go and you lead all of these things. You lead the pre-mission planning. You give the pre-mission briefing. You lead the tactical execution. You lead the post-mission debrief. I had done all of that. My version of the debrief was a 3.5-hour we all suck conversation. I mean, and all I did is emphasize how much we sucked. He came up after I was done and he flipped it around. And he taught me something really important that day. He goes, how we frame this conversation really matters. And he goes, you know, you can beat people up and tell them how much they suck and they can learn from that. And that might work in certain circumstances. But another alternative might be, hey, Cujo, we were two decisions from victory today. And if you take a look at this, we had done this and this differently, we could have won this thing. And I remember coming off of his version of the same debrief going, hey, I actually believe in my abilities right now. And I think that we actually have what it takes to be able to come back and bounce back from this thing. He actually taught me how to be resilient on the heels of a massive failure. And that was a wonderful approach. Like how we frame the discussion, like you mentioned, Marcus, the importance of humor, the importance of being able to be, you know, like have levity at times that are potentially dark. It's like, that's a special art form. That's a skill set. You know, and there's no training for that. You just experience it, and that becomes part of the culture, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I learned that. That's another key takeaway. And I try to apply that with my kids. Because if you think about it, I mean, we live in a really negative world right now. We're fed negativity. They're getting negativity all over the place. And I could continue to perpetuate that. Or I could tell my children that, you know, hey, look, you did this right. You did this right. You did this other thing right. Imagine how much better today could have gone. Can you do that, you know, better tomorrow? They tend to perk up.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a really important skill set.
It also shows that the after action debrief, imagine you plan your whole mission out, your day out, and you know where the buildings are, you know what's in there, but there's stuff you can't see, mm-hmm. right? There's variables that you can't see. That's what you find out when you go in there, and that's what we talk about. And we're like, oh, that's what actually goes in that missing spot we didn't cover down on. So if you could run it 3 or 4 times, which we try to do in our heads, I mean, always think about something 3 or 4 times before you go do it. No matter what it is. That way your mind's already thinking about it. That way when you get in there, it's like a fight or anything else. You've already done it so many times, it's like a repetitive thing. You've blotted out the mistakes that you normally would have made on the first advance. That's why we do that.
And yes.
Most people don't.
Great point about harnessing the power of simulation.
Man.
Like we go into and we simulate, so that when you actually go out there and execute, not only are you well rehearsed on what to expect, but you're so comfortable in the environment that you're ready for the pop-ups. Like you're so like yes. Your status quo is I'm ready for something else to come at me because I've experienced so much about this scenario already that I can maintain my calm and composure when something that I didn't plan for arrives over here. And I think about the application into other domains. I mean, most of the businesses where I teach this to, that we don't do a lot of simulations, which I think is unfortunate because it brings everybody's anxiety down. Yeah. It allows us to have situational awareness. Mm-hmm. We're calm, cool, and collected as we make decisions and pivots real time. It's a wonderful approach.
Basically, I mean, if you play any sport, imagine walking onto the tennis court and just start trying to play tennis against somebody who's been playing a set already.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or anything they do. If that machine's already moving, I don't care if it's smaller than you and it's already spinning and that sucker's worked up. Anything that's worked up and going, you can't stop it. If you step in front of it, run right over your ass, I mean, it'll make you look foolish.
Yeah.
And by the time when we go out that door, God, they're so jacked up and ready to go. And if they're, you know, they got that voice in that head or that music or whatever is flowing with it, you can't bring them suckers down.
Yeah. That's right.
That's so interesting. So after your military career, you wrote a book. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I wrote a couple books. Debrief to Win was the first one. I got out of the military at a time that was not of my choosing. I had colorectal cancer when I was living in Europe, right before I came back to flying F-22s again. So that led to a early retirement. And I was in a really funky place in life because if you think back to since I was 4 years old, I knew that I existed to be a fighter pilot, right? Wow. I have a hard time accepting people's thanks because I got a chance to live what it was that I knew was me. And then all of a sudden that was ripped away. And I spent some time struggling with, like, who am I now? What purpose do I serve here when I can't do what it is that I know that I was created to do? It occurred to me that one of the huge blessings of my life was being part of teams that mattered, being part of teams where it was very much a family, being part of teams that knew how to get the mission done, being part of teams that were incredibly resilient, being part of teams that kind of said, all right, disruption, come on. We're ready for you and we're going to find a way to dominate. And so I made it a mission to teach that out in the world. And I figured it'd probably be more legitimate as a potential trainer speaker if I had a book. And so I wrote a book about the art of the debrief, how it is we practice those post-mission debriefs. And it's been very, very well received. And it's helped me to be able to get the message out and how to build a team that matters, how to build a team that can win.
That's awesome.
Somebody said one to me that imagine if everyone in the military, we all lived in the same neighborhood. And when you walked out the front door in the morning, like his house, he has a jet parked in the driveway and your neighbor had a tank or something like that. And we all lived in the same spot. You can't
That'd
believe
be awesome.
How we, it would be right. How much we go at each other. But I mean, it's in a completely different dynamic than you see civilians doing it. Like when they say, they say it to hurt. And we do too sometimes, but I mean, it's also a reminder. It's weird. I don't know how we do that, but man, that was a blessing to get that out and earn that. You got to earn that.
That's right.
You know, everybody I've seen just with all of Marcus's friends and everything, when they get out of the military, they do lose this sense of purpose and the sense of teammate and all of that. But that's what family is for too. Not just the workplace, but I mean, that's like Marcus and I are our swim buddies now. Like we are the team now, and our kids and, you know, like our parents, we are that team, and we have to be able to rely on each other and respect each other. And it took us a while to kind of figure that out, but once we did, it really clicked. And
now she had to say it to me like that. She's like, "You went away to the military to get trained to come to me to do this."
Wise words.
I mean, when she said it like that, I was like, "Why do you lead with that?" I was like, I thought I had to be a husband and these kids. Yeah, I gotta, you know, raise them all day and all that. Something like that. Like, no, that's your freaking assignment.
Yeah.
Like the boys back at WARCOM and in the military, that's your ass. And that's why they separate us. Yeah. They send us back into our towns to assimilate, to try and train everyone else around us. That's why we walk the walk. Don't talk the talk. Walk the walk. Back your wife up. Raise the kids. Get them to school. Is it fun? Sometimes. No.
Yeah, like,
but that's a damn job. There's stuff we do in the military all the time. The cool stuff was we got to play with the planes and, you know, all that. And when a fight broke off, we were the ones that go whip everybody's ass. We come back, and then now we're back undercover.
Well, and if you think about it, like even just the post-mission debrief, like bringing that into just family life for our listeners, like that's what husband and wives can do when something...
She's like, "Hey, we need a debrief. Yeah. We're not going to bed, but you're mad." And I'm like, "Oh,
we need to talk about it." And
she speaks my language. You know,
let's figure out what we, you know, what can we do to avoid that situation in the future instead of like harping on it and getting angry or whatever and letting that boil. Like, let's just move on. Figure out how we can avoid that in the future and move on and just never do that again.
These are the wisest words spoken on this particular interview by far. And I tell you, as a slow learner, like the person that needs that kind of guidance and counsel in my life to be able to be focused on the right things, I was 100% skewed towards, hey, team stuff is stuff that you do at work. I taught team stuff at work. I did not teach team stuff at home until I got cancer. And it was after I kind of reviewed how it was that I allowed myself to get cancer. I had a preventable form of cancer that turned into a, you know, crushing, I'll never get away from this. It's always a reminder, don't have a lower colon anymore. Turns out I wasn't teaming well at home. And my wife and I made a firm resolution that everything that I used to live and teach applies at home first. Why? It's the most important team that I've ever been on. And I owe it to the team to make sure that we're as tight as we can possibly be. And the neat thing is that I'd say our family team got a whole heck of a lot better as a result of my failure with cancer that caused us to focus where it is that we needed to. And I'm eternally grateful for it. In fact, I wouldn't rewind the tapes and play it any other way. I think everything happened the way that it needed to. And I'm very fortunate that my bride had the compassion, the grace, the patience to deal with me so that together we could learn how to become the family team that we want to be.
Yeah.
Oh,
it always takes something.
Man, you can't even believe what they're made of until we go into the, because there's a form of human being that a military dude will turn into sometimes. When our boys aren't around and the wives, I don't know. Yeah, thank y'all. That's the hardest job. They don't get enough for payment. I mean, I don't.
Amen.
Amen, right?
100% agreed. 100% agreed. We ought to be standing for the military family members. Dang, man. And celebrating them. Yeah.
Well, I met Marcus after he medically retired, but his twin was still in, so I still like lived the deployments and all of that. And
she got the worst version of me. Bro, busted, just separated from the boys off the line. I mean, you want to talk about throwing her a wildcat. You know what I mean? She had no idea when she was out there slumming for a bad boy which one she picked up. I'll let you know how far off the beaten path she was when she came across my ass, bro, because I was, gutter cat wild.
I believe it.
Man.
I mean,
now here we are.
I tamed him.
It's a freaking chess board.
Good.
Broke that Bravo. Wild pony.
Well done.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming on and just sharing that perspective, because we never talk about that. And I don't think we've ever talked about it on our podcast.
Which is most important.
Yeah. Is that.
That's like the detail part. This is what they're talking about. It's impossible to bring out usually.
Yeah. But it really does. And it's something that's not just something that's very important in the military, but it's every household should implement that. Every household should implement like teamwork and compassion and figuring out what doesn't work and make it work.
I think the problem is you tell guys that we get out. Like, I started telling all the guys, like, y'all never get out. You never out. You take that uniform off, get to somebody else, you're going to put their name on it, but your ass is in till we die. And guess what? In this movie, we all die.
Yeah.
So just suck it up. We got work to do, man. You know, that kind of thing.
Yep. No, I get it. But I tell you what, one of the best 4-star bosses I've ever worked for, he would come in every month and ask us on the staff. He's like, hey, what are you doing for the home team? Like, because, you know, at some point you're gonna be done here, whether you get out early, whether you retire, whatever, you're gonna be done. What are you doing to make sure that there's a home team to come back to? And if you're not prioritizing that, you're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. 4-star general saying that to me. And it really kind of starts to hit home and you start thinking about where your priorities are. And anyway, I'm, again, fortunate that I married up and then I've got a wife who understood and was able to live through me like until I arrived where I needed to be, matured enough to be the husband and father that I hope to be and I'm still working on becoming.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah, amen. That's perfectly put, yeah.
So let's talk about what you've got going on now. You started a business, the VMAX Group. Can you just...
That's right.
Let's tell our listeners about that.
We basically teach how to build real teams that win. We take the principles that we lived and we apply them into typically the business domain, nonprofit domain, wherever it is we've got teams that apply at home as well, harnessing the upside of real teamwork to build what it is that our country desperately needs right now. And that is to have people of hope and optimism in a better tomorrow, people that understand how to get the best out of their teammates, people who understand how it is that we make here special. And if we can do that, if we can spread that message around at a time when there's so much negativity, then we're doing something good. And that's what we focus on.
I think you just nailed the difference. Like all the business is back and you kind of see things going in a certain way. I was like, because there is a building an awesome team, but you also need a component. You need an individual who can get it out of them. Mm-hmm. Like a battery, a plug. See, I mean, that's a real person. You can throw all the best people in one room, man, but if you don't have the person in there that can ignite them some guns, man, it won't work. That's a real thing. And most of them left when the wars kicked off. And even if they did come back or got discharged, and most of us did at ones and twos, we didn't come back together. That was the weirdest thing that we did on this one. We didn't get to come back together. It's like a hodgepodge. But we're mm-hmm. back now, mm-hmm. and everyone's here now. That's so you're seeing what's happening. Like while we were waiting to get back together, everybody got into charities. It's like most everybody got into charities to create stuff for the boys and girls who were still in. And now once that's done, because charity hurts and it lasts, but then you guys like, all right, what do you want to do now? I don't care if our boys and girls got started on a snow cone stand and wanted to make it an empire or create anything. If they put their mind to it, they can do it.
Exactly.
I mean, that's just the way it is.
Bingo. Yep. There's something special about how we developed that.
As kids, we took down Babylon. Mm-hmm. We went back over to Babylon, took that sucker down, and then Afghanistan and everything in between. And now we're back here. We're in our mids. You know, what do we want to do? Shit, whatever you want. Do whatever you want.
That's right. Right.
So how do people find you, our listeners? How can a business hire you to come on or buy your book or whatever?
There's two places. Probably the easiest place is robertteschner.com. Last name's T-E-S-C-H-N-E-R. The other one is vmaxgroupllc.com. And VMAX Groups is our company. So we've got several of us, former fighter pilots right now, that go out there and teach these principles and workshops and keynotes and making an impact, building real teams that win.
Are you on social media?
I am. LinkedIn is the best place for me there, although we're building the Facebook presence right now as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on. Appreciate great job, you. What? Yeah.
Thank hey, you. Well, I don't know if we got in. I didn't ask you this, man. Tell me about your call sign. Where'd Cujo come from?
Oh, yeah. We need an answer on that.
Yeah. Okay. Somewhat unsatisfying. It takes about 6 months until you get your call.
Real, if you started it like that.
Well, the only reason why I say it is that it's the tribe that names you. They tell stories about you. they ask you for inputs. The stories have to be 10% true, by the way, that are told about you at your naming ceremony, right? There might be some adult beverages involved. And if you can avoid weighing in on, you know, every time that they're asking, hey, is that how it went? Is that what you th-? If you can avoid saying anything, you might waltz out of there with a cool call sign. If you try to influence it, it's going to be a bad one.
Sure, sure.
All I can tell you is I can't tell you any of the stories that were told about why they named me Cujo, but the tribe picked it. They voted on it. I did not sit there and offer anything other than here's to the 58th Fighter Squadron. And until the day that I die, I prefer to be known as Cujo over Robert Charles. My mom never understood that, but it is.
Oh, there's always good stories behind it, for sure.
There are brilliant stories behind it.
I don't know how. I mean, did you hear some of these, how they come up with that? I'm like, how? I don't know how we came up with half of the material and the rules and regulations, the unwritten ones that we have to get certain things is unbelievable.
Yes.
Well, I don't watch scary movies, but Marcus told me yesterday that Cujo is some dog that kills women and children or something like that.
Yeah,
is that right?
Let me just say, do not fear. I'm more of a Benji these days, all right? Much more post-colon resection, I'm more of a Benji. But when you needed me to be a Cujo, I was a Cujo, all right?
All right, thank you so much. God bless you for being
touched. God bless you too. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet, man.
Bye.
Thank you all for listening in to another episode. We'll see you next week.